From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Although President Donald Trump's election was based primarily on a white supremacist narrative and a right-wing populism aimed at white Americans, Trump has taken pains to assure Black and Latino Americans constantly that he has benefited their communities. Trump's backers are largely white, but a small minority of non-white pro-Trump figures often garner outsized attention. The landscape of race in Trump's America has shifted in complicated ways and is the focus of a new book written by my guest Daniel Martinez-Hosang. He is an associate professor at Yale University in the American Studies and Ethnicity, Race and Migration Programs. His earlier book was called Racial Propositions, Ballot Initiatives, and the Making of Postwar California. And he is the author with Joseph E. Lowndes of the new book Producers, Parasites, Patriots, Race and the New Right-Wing Politics of Precarity. Welcome to the program, Daniel.
So happy to be here. Thank you.
So first, when we talk about Trump's America and the phenomenon that has given rise to Trump, do we tend to, you think, oversimplify? And when I say we, I sort of mean those who are not part of Trump's extremist project or support it, the rest of us. Do we tend to oversimplify or have a reductionist analysis of how race figures in this political landscape?
I think it's both what we assume and know is on the one hand quite true. It's absolutely true that the base of Trump's electorate and the Republican Party more generally is not just predominantly white, but it's one of the most white electoral bases for any presidential candidate, president in recent memory. What I think we've been less clear about is the role that Trumpism has played to at least some important figures of color, and that there's a growing presence of people of color on the right who are doing important work both for Trumpism itself, but also for an array of other projects, what we've called the multicultural far right, that works in surprising ways, particularly for white supporters of those efforts.
Right, because even though it has become popular to be openly racist, there is still a line that some people, fear to cross, including the president himself. He uses dog whistle racist language, but hates being actually called racist. And that, I think, is true for many of his supporters as well, who try to take great pains to claim they are not racist, even when their actions say otherwise, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Although I think, you know, in many cases, if you see these figures, and let's just talk about some specific examples. So on Breitbart Radio, a far right affiliated with Breitbart News Media, has two Black hosts as part of its weekly broadcast. Who I don't think are actually there just to disavow, let's say, the accusations or to indemnify listeners from the accusations that Breitbart itself is racist. They actually stand in for a certain kind of market-based, deeply patriotic, sometimes militarized right-wing politics that they're understood as being really the standard bearers of, the kind of most honest representatives. So think of, someone like Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina, wildly, wildly popular with the same Tea Party base that supports Trump. And again, not just because it allows them to disavow any commitments to racism, but because they understand Scott to be perhaps the kind of purest and most honest bearer of conservative values, much more authentic than, say, someone like Mitt Romney.
And so then that there enters into this conversation the issue of economics and one's worldview on how the economic system should run. And so explain the title of your book, Producers, Parasites, Patriots. Is that how, are those the various sectors of our, you know, society that these right-wingers divide us up into?
Well, let's, you know, the kind of subtitle of the book is The New Right-Wing Politics of Precarity. And by precarity, we mean the kind of increasing sense of vulnerability that so many feel about what the future is going to bring, the sense that the state no longer protects us from predation, no longer provides us the kinds of guarantees we might have imagined in the past. And those categories that you mentioned are actually have a long history. But the dominant way they worked was to associate whiteness with what other scholars have called producerism, the notion that you're an independent, autonomous subject, you don't take handouts from anyone, everything you've done, you've worked for, and therefore you're deserving of your status in life. And by contrast, there were those assigned to be parasites, mostly people of color in general, often Black and brown people in particular, who were assumed to be dependent, lazy, not lacking autonomy over themselves. So think about debates over welfare, think about debates over school integration, think about tax debates. And that was along the dividing line. Whiteness equaled independence and producerism. To be non-white was thought to be dependent and parasitic. Part of what led us to write this book is to notice, I mean, and those structures are enduring and they last and they continue to shape our political moment. But we noticed several years ago, remember in 2010, the midterm elections, there was a growing wave of attack against public sector workers, government workers who were unionized. Think of Scott Walker in Wisconsin. Those were predominantly white workers, 80, 90% white, and they were accused of the very same things that Black and brown people long have been accused of, which is they're dependent, they're taking advantage, they're living off the work of others, they're not producing for themselves. So we were trying to pay attention to these shifting meanings of race and class in this current moment of crisis. And at the same time, noticing the small but unmistakable uptick of some figures of color on the right who stood in for the kind of producer exemplar, the people who best demonstrated work ethics, determination, independence, or refusal to rely on the state. So those are the dynamics that we're trying to pay attention to in this book.
Now, of course, aren't there often easily proven, disproven, these claims of being independent, this, you know, we pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. Usually examining those claims doesn't hold up because almost always there is a privilege or government help that's tucked into the narrative but not expressed loudly.
That is exactly right. And these narratives don't in any exact way describe people's actual relationship to the state, to their own self-reliance. So
it's their own vision of themselves, basically.
That's exactly, and a ways to legitimate both why when a certain section of the populace gets benefits from the state, think about unemployment insurance, think about home mortgages, think about veterans benefits. Those are not understood to be an example of dependence or parasitism. Whereas things like welfare, often food stamps, Pell Grants for prisoners as other examples are understood in that language. But part of what we're trying to pay attention to is that the set of people who thought that their whiteness would protect them from accusations of being dependent and parasitic is suddenly under a certain kind of challenge.
You open your book with a discussion of Joey Gibson, the founder of Patriot Prayer, to illustrate the shifting landscape. Tell us a little bit about who Joey Gibson is and why he tends to hold people of leaders of color like Martin Luther King Jr. and movements for civil rights as his inspiration.
Yeah, so interesting. So Patriot Prayer is a group that emerges in the Portland area and the kind of Pacific Northwest just after the election. We describe them as a kind of street Trumpism, continually holding rallies around a range of right-wing issues, anti-choice, anti-LGBT, things around immigration, constantly trying to enter into physical confrontations with Antifa and other protesters from the left. But the interesting thing is they narrate themselves very much in the tradition of civil rights and even anti-racism. So Gibson himself is Asian American. Some of the other leading figures in this formation are other men of color. It's dominated by men. But for these, while the base is still mostly white men, it's not insignificant that in groups like this and the Proud Boys, a significant amount of the leadership does come from men of color who stand in for a certain kind of militarism, masculinity, a kind of refusal to be corrupted by the state. There's some purity about them that I think their white supporters, white conservatives, are deeply drawn to.
Why are they, what drives them? And I imagine that it's not just black and brown folks. You mentioned there's some Asian figures. Do you find that there are people with actual, you know, like who are first generation immigrants as well, who end up identifying as supporters of Trump and Trumpism, even though immigrants, legal or undocumented, are the focus of Trump's ire?
Yes, it's absolutely true. It runs across the board. I think we don't want to describe this in any way as representing the larger political views or behavior of these respective communities. They're not. They are very much outliers on the one hand. On the other hand, all of our communities have, you know, traditions of conservatism, of identifying with the state, the police, markets, prisons, etc. So we shouldn't be surprised that these figures will continue to circulate. I think what struck us is that they now have a deep resonance, again, even for the white base of these parties, which, you know, 40 or 50 years ago, during the high point of people like Barry Goldwater and Richard Nixon, the notion that a political party and base on the far right would be drawn to figures of color would be hard to imagine.
You write about the occupation of the Malheur National Reserve by the Bundy brothers that happened, was like maybe 2 years ago now. What did that particular showdown between the federal government and these right-wing figures represent?
Yeah. So these are far right groups. They're based in Nevada, in particular, ranchers. In the late 2015, these two ranchers were actually sentenced under a mandatory minimum sentence initiative for starting fires on public lands, and they were sent to prison. The Bundys came into Eastern Oregon ostensibly in an attempt to rally support and to, from their perspective, call out this kind of heavy-handed punishment that they were meted out, but more generally to talk about the state's role in, according to their narrative, dispossessing the hardworking, largely white rural populations of Eastern Oregon. Many organizers were quick to, and absolutely appropriately so, condemn their takeover, condemn their anti-statist critique. But what we argue is lost in that is actually in many parts of rural Oregon and other rural communities in the West, the state has in fact really, really failed to protect people from wide forms of economic vulnerability and precarity. Not just white rural folks, but people of all backgrounds. So that in that space of crisis, the counties in Eastern Oregon that they were targeting had unemployment rates, you know, oftentimes kind of 25 to 30%. Many local services had all but been abandoned because there's no longer a tax base to support them. And if progressive organizers don't have strategies, coalition building strategies in those places, it leaves open room for people from the far right, like Bundy, to insist that it's the state and the federal government itself that's responsible for their misery. And so we then, in response, just talk about groups like the Rural Organizing Project, which does tremendous work in rural organizing to build those very coalitions.
So would you say then that the broader context for what we're seeing emerging under Trump has been the failure of our economic system in general, which has unfortunately been a bipartisan project? We've seen Republicans and Democratic lawmakers together prop up markets and favor Wall Street over ordinary Americans, and that really this broader economic malaise is to blame for this very, very distorted politics that we're seeing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. As your show and your guest document so well, the crisis is becoming more and more generalizable. The dramatic forms of economic inequality that don't appear cyclical, they appear structural now. Mm. There's a permanence to them. And as they capture more and more people, as more and more people feel dispossessed by them, feel their own investment, their own trust in the dominant institutions withdrawn, it leaves open the space for these figures on the right. And the point we're trying to make is that they have actually a broad range of repertoires and strategies and tactics to draw from to advance their claims that it's not the market, it's not corporations, it's actually the government itself that's responsible for it. And they're going to be incorporating folks of color, they're going to be building multiracial coalitions, they're going to be working on a lot of that ground that I think many progressives thought the right wouldn't be interested in. So in this moment of crisis, we're trying to be alert to these new forms of politics.
So how do you explain the, within all of that, the anti-immigrant sentiment? And it seems then that Trump's single-minded focus on immigrants as outsiders and invaders, is very much part of convincing his supporters that they are the victims and these vulnerable immigrants are perpetrators looking to steal their already meager belongings.
Yeah, I mean, we understand that to be very much connected to Trump's claim in particular about the deep vulnerability and precarity of the nation. This is why it's connected to these notions of producerism and the sense that people have lost sovereignty over their own lives, their communities, and their futures. And in that sense, immigrants stand in for the kind of threat to that sovereignty. And the contention is, by building a wall, by muscular ICE enforcement, et cetera, it will restore this sense of sovereignty. So in some ways, migrants in this discourse become an object that Trump actually desperately needs. That's why he can't stop talking about that, because it helps to legitimate his contention that by investing in those particular forms of recovery, of sovereignty, that's what people's future will be more secure. I mean, the other thing is he's not above inviting some people of color into that project, including Latinos who might also imagine immigrants as threats to their well-being, African Americans who might imagine that as well.
In fact, so he probably welcomes them, right?
Absolutely, because it helps to give a much more ethical kind of light on the kind of nationalism and nativism that he's advancing. So in that sense, I know it's hard to imagine a multiracial nativism, but that's in some ways what's in the early stages of being built.
Hmm. How to counter that then, both through analysis or media coverage, but also in a systemic way because of course we're in a very dangerous moment, and so countering this phenomenon is critical. It seems like we need to talk not just about how we view or analyze what's happening now, but also how to bring about structural change to undermine it.
You know, in the conclusion to the book, we turn to Dr. King's vision in the last years of his life, to imagining a multiracial and indeed national anti-racist movement, a poor people's movement, that didn't erase the specificity of people's experiences, the challenges they face, their own lives. In other words, what happens in white rural areas of Appalachia is not the same as what happens on the border. It's not the same as what happens in Flint. It's not the same as what happens in Baltimore. And yet there are clear connections and relationships to the different kinds of abandonment that people in each of those places experience. And I think our task now is to figure out what those relationships are. Again, not to erase the really important distinctions, but to understand that they're also connected in really profound ways, and to build a politics around that. We see that happening increasingly with rural organizing that's really trying to think about the role that migrants who are whose lives have been upended by changes in the global economy, how their own lives are connected to rural folks, white rural folks, who long depended on extraction industries and because of changes in the global economy also find themselves vulnerable. So figuring out what that politics is and how we might move forward together, we think is key to responding to what I think is an increasingly sophisticated, subtle politics of precarity on the right.
Daniel, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with the book.
Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
My guest has been Daniel Martinez Hosang, Associate Professor at Yale University in the American Studies and Ethnicity, Race and Migration Programs. We've been discussing his new book, Producers, Parasites, Patriots: Race and the New Right-Wing Politics of Precarity. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.